Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. You can read our blog at kosherscene.wordpress.com. Our guest this evening is Daniel Kestenbaum from Kestenbaum & Company, auctioneers of Rare Judaica. Good evening, Daniel.
Good evening. It is a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit, how does a nice Jewish boy come to the art of auctioneering?
Well, it is less about auctioneering, and it's far more about the items, if I can say, the commodities that I do auction. And what those commodities are, and I'm not going to use that word again, is what they are is Jewish history. They are the, as curators would call, the material culture of who we are as a people, what we have done, and what we have to show for it. And what that means are books, and manuscripts, and letters, and art, and ceremonial objects, anything that exists that makes us, that surrounds us, identifying us as Jews. And that is what interests me, and always has interested me. Someone who has a passion for history, as I have had for a very long time, will want to see and want to experience material like that, not just read about it, but experience directly. And there is a very strong, it's a visceral, emotional power when you handle an item, whether it is a basic chumash, which has years, decades, centuries of use, or much more recently, if it's a letter that comes from one of the gedolim of today, that is something that immediately speaks. At least it does speak to me, and I think among the client base that I've come to know and admire, certainly speaks to them.
What was your background? What drew you towards this?
Well, it was nothing specific. This is not a family business. My father and most members of my family were in business, in export business, and fur business, and metals, not books, but I came from a cultured family, a religious family, and there was an appreciation for history, the word I'm going to use quite often. And after always reading in this area, always choosing to read books on history, Jewish history in particular, when I was a teenager, I had come across, having grown up in London, I came across a book dealer, and he very much was one of the old-time book dealers. You can kind of imagine he was a vishnisa chassid, but he kind of had this Dickensian demeanor in the sense that he put on in the morning kind of a overall to protect himself from the dust of his books, and he sat behind a desk, and occasionally people might come by. Totally didn't bother him if people did not come by, because essentially his day was spent surrounded by his farm. And I was absolutely dazzled by that kind of personality. He in turn, I think I was around 15 at the time, he was quite elderly, and I think he himself was rather amazed that someone of my age would be so interested in what it was that he was doing. And I spent many, many evenings and Sundays over quite a long period of time being in his environment, learned a great deal from him, simply because there were just thousands and thousands of books that surrounded his home. And through him, as I say, I learned a great deal and realized actually after a while that there's a panasa to be made within this world, within that particular world of books. And it developed from there.
How many years have you been doing this?
So, once I did get to the stage after studies, after a yeshiva, that it was time to focus on what it was that I needed to do in life. This isn't an area in which one can formally study. There are no college courses. It came from within me that I just felt it's something that I could move myself into. because this his name was Benim Hirschler, this gentleman, the book dealer. He was originally from Pressburg, and he had, just before the war, he had come as a young man to Manchester Yeshiva, and then the war obviously turned his world around in the sense that when the war was over, there was nowhere to go back to, and he stayed in London. He was a Malamud in the East End of London, and to kind of make ends meet, he got further involved in books. But you asked me in terms of how I came into this. I just saw that there was something available for me, and after my years being with him, he had become not necessarily so much old as much as he was more, he'd become rather immobilized, couldn't travel any longer, and I would travel on his behalf. And this was at a stage whereby Judaic had become rather well known in the mainstream antique world. There'd been a series of auctions that the Sassoon family had held, which were conducted by Sotheby's in Geneva and in London over a period of years, and in New York. And this is, again, this is like the early 80s, I think, by this stage. And once these auctions took place in New York, it captured a lot of people's interest. Question why, maybe we can come to later, in terms of Jewish community being ready and comfortable to absorb that kind of cultural experience from their own world, and not necessarily always suck culture from the non-Jewish world. But the point is that I would come to these auctions on Mr. Hirschler's behalf, and having been here a few times, I met another auction house who called Swan Galleries. They specialize in books exclusively. Other mainstream auction houses might have departments in different areas, in diamonds and in old master paintings and in Islamic art and in rare books and maybe Judaica as well. But this particular auction house was books exclusively, and they wanted to get involved with Hebrew books, and they asked me to do that for them, and I headed up that department, and that's how the journey started.
I am sure over the years you have had some very, very unusual items. Can you name some unusual, very, very old or plain, very interesting items?
Well, when I started, I settled in New York in 1985, and I joined this auction house, was told where my desk was. I was given a phone, and I was given a date. And the date was, in fact, I remember the date, September the 25th, we expect an auction from you. I knew very few people here, and picked up the phone, and I spoke to Mr. Beagleisen, who I think a lot of people will know of, and introduced myself, and I said, I have 5.5 months to make an auction of rare books, and I really don't know where to start. And through him, he introduced me to one particular dealer who, it's a very self-supporting grapevine. It's a group of people, whether they're dealers or collectors or academics, there is a great deal of passion in this field of rare books, and therefore very quickly I got to know who was who, and commercially speaking, and more importantly, who had what, and even more importantly, who didn't want what. And that's where I came in, putting this auction together. And so your question is, what are the most remarkable things I had? I think initially the most remarkable is that I survived the very first auction. And my boss said, you know what, do it again. So again, these were early days, and if I came across a book that was worth $100, it was very exciting for me because I was the one who obtained it. And what I particularly valued, and I will get to your question because I know that that is what people want to hear, the exciting, the golden fleece of Judaica. But what I also always valued was writing the descriptions, building up catalogs, giving information as to why something is significant. Because it isn't just based on the financial value, it's based ultimately on what it is, its historic background, it's the essence of it. It's chashivas in all kinds of different ways. So it took many years, many auctions, before things developed before my name became more broadly known. Putting an auction together essentially is meeting a lot of different people, seeing a great deal, many items, and selecting from those items. It's a process. What is most interesting about the process is that when you kind of go out of the process and things do appear that you just would never have expected. There have been letters from Reb Nosson of Breslov that appeared literally out of nowhere from upstate New York, and there were manuscripts from, there was a 14th century French manuscript of a Rambam manuscript which had Haggaos Maimonides that had, no one had ever seen before, and stated in Ezekiel, both of which came out of nowhere. They were completely unexpected. And yet at the same time, other collections that I've handled, I worked for a long time dealing with the Library of Jews College in London, which was a college founded in the mid-19th century. Very typically for Anglo-Jewry, it was set up because they wanted English-speaking rabbis who spoke with an English accent. It was very important to them. And they, I think the quality of the rabbis who were produced, there might be many opinions as to what kind of quality they were, but much more to the point, over a period of a century and a half, they developed a very, very interesting library. It came to the stage in recent years whereby a library like that is just not suitable for a yeshiva, and not in terms of its Lomdish needs, not in terms of Paskening needs. If you refer back to a 16th century Tshuva Sefer, you don't need the 16th century copy. So they had a library of great value, and it just wasn't necessary for their needs. And I was going through it and selecting things that would be suitable for auction, the funds for which were then put back into the college, put back into the yeshiva. And in that whole process, I came across a complete Rashi, a complete Chumash Rashi, which dated back to 1457. There is nothing from Rashi's time, nothing in his hand at all. I mean, just to put this into perspective, printing started in the mid-1460s, which is when the earliest Rashi was 1470. It wasn't exactly dated, so we speculate it's around 1470, of which no complete copy exists. So therefore, earlier manuscripts are very important, because in the centuries that went by from Rashi's death through till the first printed copy, that's going to be 2-3 centuries, and a lot might have been lost. But when you discover an early manuscript, then there's going to be a lot of interest in comparing the text of that manuscript to what we know of the Rashi today. And that was an example of something. This had been in the yeshiva library for a century and a half and had kind of gone completely under the radar, and they didn't know that they had it. And that was a discovery made in, when was that, 2001. So we think these days we've seen everything and everything's available. But in my world, I'm humbled to say there's still fascinating things out there. That is what I enjoy the most.
When I was here at your last auction, came in a few days earlier just to see some of the items, photograph some of the items, and I found it fascinating to hold some Kisvei Yad that were dating to the 10th or 11th century. Now let me ask you one question. If somebody comes to you and brings a Ksav Yad, how do you know it is not a fake? How do you know it's the real thing? How do you authenticate?
First thing I have to say is that I'm extremely fortunate that I worked together with Rabbi Eliezer Katzman, who is a Talmud Chacham to the most profoundest degree. And the very first thing I do is that anything that that requires that level of expertise and that level of research that's needed, I refer immediately to Rabbi Katzman. But It would be very unusual. I mean, overall, it's very unusual that a manuscript is fake. I mean, we grow up with the idea, or we're kind of used to the idea that you might have a multi-million dollar painting that's faked, or there's an extremely expensive piece of silver or diamond that is faked, and that goes on. There's some very brilliant craftsmen who know how to do that. Within the world of books and manuscripts, it's far, far less likely. The kind of person who would fake something would be the kind of person who would want to do that for financial gain.
Right.
And of which there isn't, not particularly so, given the effort that it would take to decide to fake a garnet manuscript or something of the like. It's just very unlikely to happen. And yet, on the other hand, there are incidents, strange things that can take place. Someone might fake a Hasima or Hagoras on the side of a particular sefer, and that has happened. And so how does one know? You have to be diligent and make sure you consult with people who are smart and genuinely do know. No one is infallible. So could mistakes have happened? Yes. In my experience, it hasn't happened. At least it hasn't happened yet.
I'm also sure over the years you must have had some very interesting stories, incidents that happened. Maybe something inspiring, maybe something absolutely incredible, maybe something with a touch of humor, intended or unintended. Can you tell us something?
So before you came, that is exactly the kind of stories that we were thinking about and wanted to be able to say now and to tell over now. Different kinds of stories come to mind. I think the stories that are the most interesting are the stories that I can't tell you. And they are the stories that relate to the characters and the kinds of people who own a particular book or a particular collection, or how they came to own that particular collection. And another reason why I find this field extremely interesting, or anyone who comes into this field and walks into an auction exhibition, they will find some very colorful characters and the kind of individuals who like to talk, because that's why they are involving themselves in this field, because there's a great deal of, I'll use the word joy, in knowledge and in learning and in Torah. And not necessarily the kinds of people you might meet every day. And even more so, what I'm also very charmed by is that I find that when we conduct these exhibitions, the people who are coming from such a wide, diverse range of communities. And it is very, very fine to see that you will have someone who ordinarily would never speak to a person, the kind of person who might walk on the Israel Day parade is never going to be speaking to someone who might be an organizer of the recent Hasifa. I don't know, to stretch the point, this might be a bit of an exaggeration, but I use the Israel Day parade again, the kinds of people who might have been demonstrating against it, and the kinds of people who are walking on it, they actually might have exactly the same interest when they come to an exhibition, and then as equals will discuss a particular letter or some correspondence or something they found in the exhibition, which they as equals enjoy. And that is a level that I really do find very satisfying. I don't think that anywhere else in any other venue within the Jewish world or the non-Jewish world, you will have Jews coming together and not have any sense of any attitude one to the other, any of whatever stripe that could be. Now you have to remind me of your question.
Well, first I want to make a comment. When I was here last time at the actual auction, I was amazed to see from an uncovered head through the kippah suga, through the guy with the beaver hat. I mean, everybody seemed to be here, and everybody, you know, there was, while as you said, there might have been a tremendous clash in the case of an Israeli Day Parade type of event. Up here, they were all the same. Everybody was here for the same reason. There was no animosity, no politics, nothing.
Exactly. And I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased by that. It gives me a lot of satisfaction.
Any interesting stories, which is basically
right.
What I asked.
Oh yes, the story. Okay, so we came up with one great story, entirely true, and like all great stories, it starts off entirely unexpected. And this is our story, which we can entitle The Prague Haggadah and the San Diego Yoga Teacher and the F-14 Jet. So how does
okay.
it come together? I receive a lot of inquiries. I have such and such a book, and my Zadie had this and that, and of course the Baal Shem Tov tefillin regularly appear every week. Everybody has a Baal Shem Tov tefillin. There are genuine, I mean, more than genuine, they're very regular inquiries, which I welcome. People want to know what I have. Is this something of significance? Not even necessarily of value, not necessarily something to sell. I'm available and I'm very happy to provide that sort of information. Admittedly, it's a commercial concern, so therefore if it does then trickle down into putting something up to auction which does have, which is suitable for auction sale, then of course we accommodate that. So one day, I receive an email from someone I've never heard of. Could you look at, I'm sending some attachments of some books, could you take a look, tell me what I have. So I open the attachments, and immediately, the things that tend to take the most time tend to be the things which aren't necessarily the things that you jump up and down about. But this is something that I opened up, and immediately I knew this was an extraordinarily rare book. And what it was the very first illustrated Pesach Haggadah. Prague, 1526. Not only was it the first Haggadah which had pictures, they are the most extraordinarily finely, amazingly designed illustrations with a very strong Gothic element. Even the lettering on each page is a work of art. And within collector circles, this really is one of the most desirable books to own if you really are a serious collector. Needless to say, it's extraordinarily rare. Haggadahs were used, and Haggadah since 1526 has been used a lot. And when I say they were used and basically thumbed into oblivion, and when you can't use it any longer, you put it into Seamus, and
right.
That's the end of that, which is understandable, except that 400 years later, we wish they hadn't put it into Seamus, because now we see it not just as a Haggadah in terms of a utilitarian object, but Haggadah, this is a historic, magnificent, wonderful piece. And they aren't around, and where are they? And collectors must have them. So when one comes up out of the blue, it's an exciting moment. So I contact this person, and I say, yes, I'm familiar with this book. And I'm very interested, and sort of leave it at that. I don't want to suddenly jump up and down too much. I don't know who she is, and I don't know how best to play this. So she tells me, she's a Swiss, this woman, who I'll leave nameless for
mm-hmm.
now, and she had moved to San Diego quite some years earlier, and her father had passed away recently, and she'd gone back to Switzerland to take care of papers, take care of the household, and there were some books. This is a Jewish woman, and there were some Jewish books, some sfarim, some bits and pieces that she had put into a box and took back with her to California. They sat around for a while, and like most people, I have to find out what this is, but then life gets in the way and doesn't really happen. And then one day she said, you know what, let's find out. She found me, sent me these images, And put it this way, no matter how cautiously or cool I wanted to play this, within 36 hours I was at the front door. However, I wasn't entirely at her front door, but actually just to backtrack a little bit. So again, it really was established. She did have a Prague Haggadah, and I was extremely keen, I guess I could even say concerned. How did she come to have it? But the story was the story. These things sometimes simply do happen. People have inherit things that are wonderful. Doesn't often happen, but it can happen. In this case, it does happen. So it was clearly established what it was. She decided, she was very pleased to know how much I knew about it, and she welcomed my visit. So this Haggadah appears in Prague in 1526. Who knows where it had been? This is always the extraordinary mystery of books. Where have they been over the period of time before they land on my desk? Except we know that in the 1940s, she said very soon after the war, her father, who had interest in antiques, he would poke around and things were available for all kinds of obvious reasons after the war. And he bought some art and some books, and this is the book, and she has it. But I know nothing more, and she knows nothing more about it. So it survives, what is that, half a millennia, and it's about to come into my hands. And so to say, I'm about to get to her front door, and in my rented car, not having been to San Diego before, I'm following my GPS, and there's a huge roadblock, just literally two blocks away from her home. There is an Air Force base in that area. Again, this is all news to me. I had no idea. And had no idea this was actually going to come into play in my visit to pick up a Prague Haggadah. There'd been a crash. One of the jets on a training session had taken off and crashed on her street. Plane came down on her street.
Ouch.
Pilot ejected. No one was hurt. However, there was clearly going to be no way that I was going to be able to drive to her. Reached her over the phone. They weren't allowing anyone out from the street. I mean, the police basically had no idea what was going on. Everyone was pretty horrified. I mean, I'm putting a light gloss to the story, but the reality is it was a pretty horrific situation. But the point is that we eventually meet up. She finds her way out through her back garden and through her back neighbor's back garden, and we meet up at Starbucks. Where else does one meet? And she has the Haggadah with her. And it was absolutely thrilling to see it. But I was very aware. We met, we spoke, we came to an agreement, and I came back with it to New York that evening. And what I found absolutely remarkable was that this Haggadah survived all this time and was two doors away from ending its time, care of the U.S. Air Force. So, you know, if we talk
about... The defenders of the free world, yes.
You know, if there's ever a story which involves Hashkacha, I think this has to be it. And so the story, the Haggadah came up for auction. In fact, it was very shortly before Pesach, which was about 2 years ago. And the individual who bought it... who is a client I know well, who lives in Israel, and I happen to have been going to Israel for Pesach, and I said I'll deliver it for him. And despite me being the polite, retiring Englishman, I did ask him, I would like to use it. And I thought, obviously, I'm never going to have this opportunity again. I will bring it to you, Chol HaMoed. Would you mind if I use it at my family Seder? And he said, yes. And I took it out and made Kiddush from this Haggadah, and that is an example of my experience. Making Kiddush from that Havdalah is very hard to put into words. It's a moving, a deeply moving experience. The story has all kinds of turns and somersaults, but the bottom line basically is, despite the humor that might be in it, the kedusha of a sefer and how that sefer impacts on who one is as a Jew, that's what this is all about, and that is essentially how I see what I do. It is my joy and my thrill to be able to find these things and to return them to the hands of people who appreciate them, and not just put them behind glass doors in a museum, mm-hmm. but they should be on someone's Shabbos table.
When I was here last time, going back to that again, I happened to hold one of the volumes of the first printed Mikros Gedolos, and it got very emotional
mm-hmm.
to actually hold something like that.
Right, 100%. But I think, to commend you, it's a certain special kind of Jew who has that feeling. And I think there are a great many of them. And,
yes.
I think that people need to understand that this is available. And the rare those things are, the reality is that, yes, on West 30th Street, around the corner from Madison Square Garden, you have the first Mikros Gedolos available to
right.
you to hold. Whether you're going to buy it or not, you might not have those kinds of funds. But the reality is that it's here. And I find nothing more charming that on an exhibition day, a parent will come along with one of their children and show their child, look what this sefer is. And whether the child perceives it then and there, I don't know, but certainly...
At some point he will, no question.
Right, exactly.
You have another upcoming auction. Tell us a little bit about it. What are some of the highlights, and in general, what the auction is about?
Well, we have auctions every 3 months, it's not a situation where any one particular auction will have a theme, only in the sense that I can't consciously decide, as much as I'd like to, but I can't consciously decide, right, this auction will be the history of Hasidus, and then have a representative first edition of every sefer from every particular Hasidic dynasty, or on an entirely different level, whether it's Zionist history or Haskalah, or within every significant Shuvah sefer. It doesn't work like that, because essentially what I do is what I'm able to find. This particular auction, it's 420 lots. It is a very, very broad range of material. It does actually have one particular center, and that is, it's a collection that we've been handling now for about a year and a half. When I say I've been handling, what that implies is that an individual might have a large library of a few hundred or a couple of thousand books, and over a period of time, then these books are pushed out to auction, rather than all of a sudden 2,000 books being available. It's just too much for people to absorb at any one particular time. So this library is known as the Kasuto Collection. It belongs to a gentleman who lives in Lisbon, Portugal. He's his name is Alvaro Kasuto, and he is the principal conductor of the Lisbon Philharmonic Orchestra.
Mm.
He's a very fine man. What is quite extraordinary about him is that he traces his family not through wishful thinking and very directly back to the original Kasutos, who settled in Portugal in the mid-1400s. More than that, the library that he is responsible for is a library that was formed in the late 1700s. And he, his ancestors have carried it all the way down. He's not able to pass this on to the next generation, and he has decided that it should be sold. I think ideally he wanted it to go to the Hebrew University, and arrangements weren't able to be made. And his perspective is that in some ways, now that he's experienced two of the auctions here, that he is actually rather thrilled by the fact that when he sees the kinds of people who are buying his books, as he puts it, the kind of person who will reach into their pocket and spend the money to buy any particular book, whether it's a $200 book or a $20,000 book, he knows that book is then going to be taken care of. And although it's dispersed, man is mortal. None of these, all of this material is going to outlive us. So therefore the issue is, are you going to be the appropriate custodian to look after this book during the time of your life, you know, during the course of your life? So that's what he experienced. And I mean, he's just one aspect of this auction. It's a collection of about 50 books in this sale. And the rest of the sale ranges from art to chafetzim, to menorahs and the sermon boxes, but our heart and soul is really focused on books and manuscripts. I'll tell you about two pieces in particular that I think are quite unusual. They both are 20th century. Which actually is interesting and important to say, because Judaica rarities is not based on age. Someone will call me up and say, I have such and such, and it's dated 1694, therefore it must be extremely valuable. Now, it is valuable in the sense, let's say it's a Tehillim, that's very significant. And you know, one would like to believe those succeeding centuries, people have used that Tehillim, and every day, Kapitel Tehillim has been said by generation after generation, so sure, that's valuable. But commercially speaking, age doesn't necessarily equal value. So in the case of this one particular item, it is it's a letter, it's really more of an announcement that was written in 1935. So again, an example of something historically significant, which will be valuable. It is estimated at quite a few thousand dollars. Written in 1935, and it is an announcement pleading with the powers that be who run the Maccabi Sports Association in Israel, in Eretz Yisrael of the time, pre-state, that they shouldn't play soccer games on Shabbos. And the announcement writes at length how the Kedusha of Shabbos is what's central to Am Yisrael, and thinking of changing that, certainly in Yerushalayim, is a bizarion, and hurts us deeply in terms of who we are as a people, and it is very beautifully written. What is extraordinary about it is the people who actually, it has about 20 signatures at the bottom, and the people who sign this letter are absolutely not the people who you would have expected at all. You would have expected the likes of you and I, and perhaps the Kehillas that we live in, and the Hamish of Elk would put their names to something like this. A Kolkara like that is obvious. But the people who actually signed this were the creme de la creme of the cultural and intellectual leadership of the pre-state of Israel. People like Bialik, people like Agnon, Dinur, people who you would never have expected, who actually quite the opposite, they left Yiddishkeit, they fled from Yiddishkeit. And yet here they are pleading with one of the central organizations of central Zionist organizations, which were seeking to have what they would regard as a quote normal country. Don't do this, because we don't want a normal country. What we want is a Jewish country. The catalogue that we've recently issued has gone out, and I think this is an item that I think we've had more questions or more comments than anything else, because it's just so surprising and so out of the ordinary. And a historical document like that is very significant. What someone might choose to do with it, I mean, I don't necessarily mean the buyer, but I mean how you want to spin this politically, how you want to spin this hashkafically, I don't know, I'm not going to comment. But the fact is, it is very important to see that it's such a historical document exists.
Absolutely, and with names like Bialik, as you said, it's astonishing.
Right.
Even though he was himself in his early years a yeshiva bocher.
Right.
But went of the fold.
The Masnet, which is his famous poem.
Right. Okay, and we're just about out of time, so tell us, when is the next auction? How can people get in touch with you? Where are you located? Where is the actual auction going to be physically held?
Right, so we are located at number 242 West 30th Street, and our offices, our gallery, our exhibition space is all located at that spot. The auction itself, this particular auction we're referring to, is on the 21st of June, which is Thursday. It's Thursday afternoon. And what we do is that we have a viewing period in the few days leading up to that auction, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, in which people are welcome to come and view the items. What I strongly suggest is what they do is they should see the catalog ahead of time. It's much as though I say that I welcome people to come, and people are welcome to come, but less so to browse, in the sense that it is an educational experience, and our catalogs, sounds like I'm promoting the catalog more than I'm promoting the items themselves, but the catalog really explains in great detail. We have a team of very fine researchers who discuss at length what each item is. So the catalog can be accessed online. We have a website, which is kestenbaum.net, N-E-T. And the catalogs can be seen over the web. Or hard copy catalogs can be mailed if you contact the office. Again, through the website, all the contact details are there. And the auction itself, as I say, is on Thursday afternoon. But the key, I would say, would be to have an understanding of what it is that's being auctioned. Our phone number is, if you want to contact that way, is 212-366-1197. And we're open every day between 10 and 6. And as I say, the exhibition will start on Sunday, opening at 12 noon through till 6, and every subsequent day between 10 and 6.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kestenbaum. It was interesting, it was informative, it was entertaining. The type of guest that I like to have over and over again. Thank you for being a perfect guest. Good night, and thank you one and all, ladies and gentlemen. And remember to tune us in again next week, next Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thank you.